is ready to hear argument in 050849 PAG versus the Hanover Insurance Company. Justice Brister is sitting in this case, but did not be present for argument.
May it please the Court, Mr.
Manowski
will present
argument for the petitioner. Petitioner reserves 7 minutes. Baxter Manowski for the petitioner, PAJ. May it please the Court. This case involves primarily a question about the interpretation of commercial general liability policies in the state of Texas. Briefly, PAJ...
These are form policies.
These are form policies. And PAJ is in the business of, not that it matters particularly to the case, but is the business of distributing jewelry. And from 1993 to 1999, PAJ obtained from the respondent, Hanover Insurance Company, commercial general liability policies. Those policies provided, among other things, advertising injury, which provided defense and indemnification related to claims of copyright infringement. In December of 1998, it's undisputed, during the term of the last policy that Hanover issued, PAJ was sued for copyright infringement. Unfortunately for PAJ, at least the employees at PAJ who were responsible for responding to the German lawsuit, were not aware that there was a covered claim under the policy, and the issue didn't come up until some months later during their process of meeting with their insurance agent and looking at getting renewal coverage on their general liability policy. At that time, some months later, I believe the stipulation was 4 to 6 months later, the insurance company was placed on notice. In this case, the case was decided entirely on stipulated facts, and among the stipulations were that the notice was not as soon as practicable. It came some 4 to 6 months after the lawsuit was filed.
Does that matter when there's a notice provision that the insurer needs to be put on notice so it can properly defend the insured?
Well, certainly in order to tender a defense, the insurance company has got to know that there's a case pending. And PAJ is not arguing that the insurance company did anything wrong for not tendering a defense during the period of time that it was not aware that there was a lawsuit pending. The other stipulation, which is material to this case, is that the insurance company stipulated that it was not prejudiced by the delay in receiving notice of suit. So the question that comes before this court are essentially twofold. Number one, whether the notice provision is a condition precedent under the policy, and if so, what effect that has, and if not, what effect that has. Obviously, I think under this court's ruling in Hernandez, if the term is not considered a condition precedent, but is considered a covenant under the policy, that these are duties that the insured has, then under the plain analysis of Hernandez, the insurance company, in order to show materiality of a breach, would have to show that it was prejudiced, which the insurer cannot do in this case. Nevertheless, even if the court determines that the notice provision, is a condition and not a covenant, there still remains a question whether or not, under Texas law as it currently exists or as it should exist, whether the insurer should be allowed to capitalize on the late notice in situations where it's not been prejudiced in any way in order to basically create a forfeiture situation.
Shouldn't there be some guidelines? I mean, depending on the type of litigation, you can wait months, you can wait weeks, you can wait perhaps even a couple of years and ensure not be prejudiced.
Well, I think the guidelines that are set forth, and there's another distinction that's got to be drawn, and there have been amici briefs that have been filed And that is between claims made policies and occurrence policies.
Sure.
The policy issue here is occurrence policy. And what that means is that the triggering event for coverage is that an occurrence happened during the policy period. There's no question that a covered event occurred during the policy period here. In a claims made policy, there are often specific reporting requirements that are specifically negotiated. In fact, some claims made policies include what are called extended reporting requirements, which says that the claim has got to be first made during the policy period, and that the parties may negotiate for some period of time after the policy for the claim to be reported. And so in that case, it's clear that there may very well be specific guidelines. And the courts that have looked at the distinctions have noticed that the claims made policies, that the claims history is an integral part in the underwriting and the setting of premiums going forward, and they need to know and it's important for the insurer to know at the time it's writing the new policies what its exposure is on its old policies, which is not.
Those kinds of considerations may be part of what led us to say in Cutea that this is a matter for the insurance department to work through. Why isn't that still true?
Well, if we look at Cutea, one of the things that we see is that Cutea, because of its age, involved policy language that was materially different than the language in the policies here. One of the things that we all know is, as a result of the court's decision in Cutea, at least it appears that as a result of that decision, the insurance board promulgated a rule which required a showing of prejudice under the bodily injury and property damage portions of a commercial general liability policy.
But it does look like that. And we said, well, this is really something they should do, and then they did it. Then why shouldn't we live with that decision?
And I'll tell you why, for a couple of reasons. One, at the time, there was no advertising injury that was being offered in these policies, so it would not have made sense, would not have been possible for the board to issue an order that also reflected that. Additionally, the language has changed. And so since the policy language has changed and since the board is required to approve the policy language in the form policies that are promulgated, then it can have affected its administrative review and change by the way that it approves the policies.
Why would it approve an endorsement for coverage A that required prejudice and an endorsement for coverage B that doesn't?
Well, the board order with respect to the endorsement that requires prejudice, as the court knows, is a very old endorsement. It hasn't been rescinded, and I don't know that there'd be any reason to rescind it. But the Cutea court, one of the things that came out in the Cutea court was the distinction or the understanding or the acknowledgement that the plain wording of the contract required a finding of a condition precedent to coverage. The court says that they are faced with the plain wording of the contract, and they also say, in looking at sort of the history of this notion that notice provisions are conditions, it goes on to say, after all, that's what the contract says. But that's not what our contract says. The Cutea contract specifically included the language that says this is a condition precedent. It used that magic word.
But Section 4 of this policy says commercial general liability conditions.
It does say commercial conditions, and if you look at the policy under that, in fact, that's really the only basis, I think, from an interpretation standpoint, to find that this provision, this subsection on notice could be a condition, is that the major heading above it just says conditions. But if you look at the other items that are listed, there's 9 of them. In addition to the notice, there's an item on bankruptcy, legal action against us, and I'll get back to that because that's an important provision. Other insurance, premium audit, representations, separation of insureds, transfer of rights of recovery against others, and when we do not renew. And so we can't say, and if just looking at the policy briefly, you can't come to the conclusion that all of those provisions are conditions, and if all of those provisions are not conditions preceded, then the fact that some heading has a term that says conditions there's no way then to parse them out. Importantly, number 3, legal action against us. In the Cutea court, that similar provision said, unless you do certain things as a condition precedent, there's no coverage. Unlike the Cutea court, in the PHA policy, The provision says no person or organization has a right under this coverage part to sue on this coverage part unless all its terms have been complied with, and deletes the very important, I think critically important, provision that was in Cartagena that says that that's a condition precedent. And in fact, if you read that section, it's, and you determine that, that the notice provision is a condition, then what that means is that every requirement that's placed on the policyholder in the entire policy, with the exception of, I guess, paying the initial premium, is a condition. Because it's so broadly written that it says, unless you comply with every term of the policy, you don't have any coverage. And so if we're going to follow the logic that the respondent suggests, and that is that these two sections create a condition, then we have to assume that the only covenant that a policyholder makes is a covenant to pay the premium. In this case, PAJ paid premiums for 6 years. The insurance company was not prejudiced by any delay in notice, and it suffered a complete forfeiture of its rights under the policy. If you look at the decision in Hernandez,
does it matter if the insurer stipulated on the notice provision that it was not prejudiced? What if there was no stipulation there? What impact would that have?
Well, if there's no stipulation, then it's going to be a fact question, I think, whether or not there's prejudice. In this case, obviously, if prejudice is not required, then the stipulation doesn't matter. It's our position that the stipulation matters because prejudice is required and should be required. If prejudice is not required, it doesn't matter. If prejudice is required and the insurance company doesn't stipulate, then it may be a fact question. It may be that, like so many cases have held in so many different contexts, that prejudice is assumed as a matter of law. Somebody's gotten a default judgment against them, and you know the insurance company didn't have an opportunity to defend, or whatever. There's lots of ways that prejudice can be established even as a matter of law. But there's lots of contexts, and one of the things that this court noted in Cartagena was that not only was the condition express and therefore had to be a condition under the policy, the court also noticed that the result was unjust. And the court should recognize today that all of the cases that evolve suggesting or holding that these notice provisions are conditions involve and evolve from policies that use different language 30, 40, 50 years ago. And the fact that the Cartagena court determined that something was a condition based on language used 30, 40, or 50 years ago should not suggest that this court should do likewise just because that's what we've always said. In fact, what the PAJ court did, the Court of Appeals in this case did, is it actually created what I think is a new rule of interpretation that says for notice provisions and insurance policies, we're going to presume their conditions unless the intent to create a covenant is expressly created, which stands in stark contrast with this court's holding in Hernandez that insurance policies are contracts. And as contracts, the regular rules of construction apply. That rule of construction doesn't apply to any other contract anywhere. So to find that that rule applies here is to say that really insurance contracts, we treat them differently and we have special rules for them that don't apply to other contracts. And I see that my time is up. Are there any other questions?
Seeing none, counsel, thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Fielder will present argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Justice Heck, Cartagena is still good law. Cartagena was followed no less than 5 months ago by the Illinois Supreme Court in the case of County Mutual Insurance Company versus Lavorsi Marine. It appears in 2000, Illinois Lexus 623.
What does the contract language say there, the notice provision?
The notice provision, it's very similar to, I think it's very similar to the notice language in this contract.
What does it say?
I have to find it.
Because this notice provision, really the only thing that makes it a condition is the title at the top, condition.
I don't see
any unless or if or, you know, qualifying language. As in Cartagena, it said a condition precedent.
And I would respectfully disagree with the court that it fits the definition of condition precedent. Just because it doesn't say it's one doesn't mean it isn't. In the legal sense, and I'm paraphrasing here, I should say, a condition precedent is something that occurs subsequent to the making of a contract but must occur before liability attaches. That is exactly what we have here with this notice provision. A contract.
But you'd agree that there's a presumption that that something is a covenant unless it's clearly a condition precedent, right?
I would agree with that.
Then show me what here that makes this clearly a condition precedent in this particular policy language.
I think it clearly is a condition precedent because of the nature of what it does. It is something that comes after the formation of a contract but must occur before liability attaches. And that is precisely what the purpose of this is. It is a condition preceding the liability.
You spoke about purpose. What's the purpose of a notice requirement?
The purpose of the notice requirement is so that the insurer can, in fact, be put on notice and come in and defend the case.
And what precluded the insurer from defending the case here?
The insurer did defend the case once it was put on notice.
Right. And so my question is, why, if the purpose was satisfied here, and you stipulated to no prejudice, why should we construe this to disallow coverage?
Well, you should follow this court's prior ruling in Cudahy, which still is good law. There is no prejudice requirement in this policy.
And for the,
I'm thinking about the underlying purpose of the provision was satisfied in this case so that the insurer wasn't prejudiced. And I'm just trying to get to the policy reason without, you know, we have Hernandez as well, so.
Okay, the public policy reason, if that's what the court is asking me, I will back up to Cudahy. This court deferred to the legislature or the State Board of Insurance to create forms in the policies or to create law in the insurance code which would require prejudice to be shown.
Well, and the policies that they have promulgated have deleted the conditions precedent language.
The policies they have promulgated have retained the condition preceding language, but engrafted under the bodily injury and property damage coverage a requirement of prejudice. That has never been done.
My understanding is in the Cataya policy, it said as a condition preceding.
It said that as a condition preceding.
And that has been deleted now in this form.
That is not in the form in that exact language. That's true.
And you would read no intent into deleting as a condition preceding.
No, I wouldn't. And I would point out, while I don't have a Texas case on that point, the Nevada Supreme Court didn't either, and I was going to talk about that case in a minute. Maybe this is the time to do it.
Let me just ask you this. You said something to the effect, just because it doesn't say it isn't, doesn't mean it isn't, in response to Justice O'Neill's question about the laundry list of things that were pointed out by Mr. Bernowski. And you say this is a condition preceding. That reminds me of, you know, some comment depends what the definition of is. How are we supposed to figure it out if the policy isn't clear?
I think that the definition of condition preceding is clearly met here. I think this is a classic condition preceding. It is something that occurs after the making of the contract.
So is every one of those laundry list of things in the other section?
No.
Then how are you to distinguish it? Just by your interpretation of it? Is it ambiguous? Or
I don't think it's ambiguous at all. And I would point out to the court that if the court doesn't think this language is a condition preceding, then that is essentially overruling about 60 years of Texas case law and very far out of the mainstream of the remainder of American jurisprudence. I can't find cases anywhere in this country where courts have said that this isn't a condition preceding, except one federal court.
But you're talking about two different types of policy language. The policies aren't written exactly the same. The language has changed.
There are changes in the language over the years. There's no doubt about
but
that.
But you don't seem to give them any import, the changes in the language. When they remove qualifying language like unless, if, and as a condition precedent, isn't that some indication that the legislature or that the insurance commissioner did exactly what they needed to do to remove it as a condition precedent?
I don't think so, because a lot of the language is still the same. In the brief of petition.
Is there unless or if or condition precedent in here?
There is not an unless or an if. There is language, when construed as a whole, which says that you have to give us notice, and if you don't comply with that notice, you can't sue us on the policy. That's the no action clause of the policy. And I think that, taken as a whole, is the condition preceding. I mean, this is, to me, clearly a condition preceding. It is something that has to occur after the making of the policy for liability to attach. If notice isn't properly given, the liability of the insurer doesn't attach. And that is a condition preceding under the court's definition in Hohenberg, which defines what a condition preceding is.
I just wanted to be clear. The endorsement that says you must show prejudice with respect to bodily. That is in this policy.
It's in the policy for the bodily injury and property damage. And our argument is that if the State Board of Insurance or the legislature had wanted to cause that type of endorsement or that type of law to be present for prejudice, they have had a number of years to do that and have failed to do so.
But can you think of a policy reason why they would require prejudice for that type of coverage but not for advertising injury?
Very easily.
Injury. Why?
The CATEA opinion and any opinion dealing with an automobile policy deals with unsophisticated consumers and what is now a mandatory automobile policy. My expectation is that those consumers probably haven't read their policy and might not understand it even if they did. A commercial general liability policy deals with sophisticated businesses who negotiate an insurance policy at arm's length. They go through an agent. They can have manuscript endorsements to the policies. They have risk managers. They have lawyers, some of them probably on staff, who can assist them, and they could pay a premium for whatever kind of manuscript endorsement they want. That's not just my idea. A case that I frankly should have cited to the court but didn't is New Era of Networks, Inc., which is a federal district court here in Texas by Federal Judge Gilmore. The Lexis site on it is 2003 U.S. District Lexis 14259. And Judge Gilmore does a far better job than I do in my brief in discussing the very position we're advocating here, starting at page 4. And one of the things she discusses is the public policy argument that the court has just asked me, and she points out that these businesses are not in the same bargaining position as consumers are in. So there is no strong public policy requirement that there be a prejudice requirement in a CGL policy on advertising injury. There would be a stronger argument, frankly, when Cudahy was decided. But this court chose not to do that and instead to defer to the State Board of Insurance or to the legislature. And that is still good law and should be good law.
So you think that the parties would negotiate a term that if they missed a notice provision like this, that was the bargain that they entered into, they would negotiate that?
I think what the parties would negotiate would be an endorsement that requires prejudice. I think that a party could
But so because they have lawyers involved and they're sophisticated people, that it would be okay to essentially forfeit their policy because of this.
Sure.
Non-prejudicial back.
I think they could do that for a premium. I'm sure there's an actuary who could sit down and figure out what that endorsement would cost, and I'm sure that a business could sit down and have that manuscript endorsement put on the policy. General liability policies have many, many manuscript endorsements. I think this court has had to construe on several occasions some of them that have come up involving additional insured endorsements. There's no reason that can't be done in this context. This is not the typical unsophisticated consumer situation.
Is the stipulation of that is there, does that equate to a non-material breach?
No. The stipulation of prejudice was for the summary judgment only, first off, and I don't know if that's been made clear to the court. It was just for the summary judgment. And all that says is that we weren't prejudiced by that because we contend that the only issue is whether or not timely notice was given. And that was stipulated, I might add, that it wasn't. So they have stipulated that they didn't give notice as soon as practicable for the purpose of this summary judgment. We stipulated we weren't prejudiced by it, thereby bringing the question to the court that's here.
What's the answer to that question, though? Assuming there was no prejudice, would that amount to a non-material breach?
Assuming there was no prejudice, would that amount to a non-material breach?
My understanding of your position has been it's a non-material breach,
well,
but if it's a condition preceding.
Right, it doesn't matter, and that's exactly what I was going to say. Is it's a non-material breach because that's not in the equation for the question of whether or not it's a condition preceding. If it's a condition preceding, then the failure to comply with it negates the policy. If it is a covenant, which would be a unique determination and totally contrary to what every other court has said, then it would be a question of whether it's a material breach or not, and having said it wasn't, that would matter. But our position is it doesn't matter. Prejudice doesn't matter. And I would like to return to the case that I had briefly talked to the court about, and that's the case out of the case is out of Nevada. And this court is in a remarkably similar position as Nevada Supreme Court was in a case called Las Vegas Star Taxi versus St. Paul Fire and Marine, which is at 714 Pacific 2nd, 562, 1986. What had happened is in 1950, the Nevada court in the Casinanelli case, and I probably mispronounced that, 216 Pacific 2nd, 606, held that the failure of an insured to perform the policy's express condition precedent, affording to State Farm within a reasonable time the suit papers in an action against him, precluded Casinelli from recovering on the policy and rendered the issue of prejudice immaterial. 36 years later, or 34 years later, I would say, it's close, the insured came back, another insured, with another bite at the apple. The argument was exactly the argument you're hearing here today. The language had changed. It was not a condition precedent. The term condition precedent had been taken out of the language. And therefore, the court should hold that because the change had occurred and because it was no longer a condition precedent, the insured would be entitled to recover in the Las Vegas Star Taxi opinion. The Nevada Supreme Court held that the fact that the words condition precedent didn't appear in there anymore didn't matter. The court looked at the purpose of the notice provision and held, as courts have held many, many times, that it was, in fact, a condition precedent. The court declined to change its position on the prejudice situation. In fact, didn't even really address it.
Can you give me that slide again?
Sure, I'm sorry. 714 Pacific 2nd, 562, and I would a great discussion of this appears.
Well, but let me ask you this. Is it your position that all notice provisions, no matter how they're written, are conditions precedent?
I haven't seen one that didn't, so yes. I can't imagine how it wouldn't be a condition precedent. And again, if we step back from whatever you want to call it in the policy, whether it comes under the condition section, which I don't know matters that much, we look at what things are, not what they're called. And it is a condition precedent by the nature of what a condition precedent is. Something that occurs after the formation of the policy, but must occur before liability attaches. That's a condition precedent, and this is a classic condition precedent, and this court has said that six or seven times in the last 60 or 70 years. No court in Texas has ever held anything to the contrary.
The language here, 2A, sounds to me more like a covenant. You must do this. You must notify us. It doesn't say unless you notify us, there's no coverage. It just says you must do this. You must see to it. And that is not as strong as unless you notify us, there will be no coverage under this policy.
The words must and shall appear for the last 60 years.
Well, but we have a long line of jurisprudence that says the words must and shall, unless it says what will happen if you don't, aren't conditions precedent.
This court has repeatedly construed language that says must and shall, and repeatedly said it's a condition preceding in the insurance context. Virtually, I think, three or four of the opinions that are Supreme Court opinions that are in our brief, those very words appear, and this court held anyway that it was a condition preceding to liability. There has never been a determination to the contrary in this state. And the Nevada opinion, while I realize it's not binding precedent on this court, nonetheless, the Nevada court made quick work of the argument, and there's a goodness.
Did you just say that the headings and the terminology in these policies don't mean anything?
No, if I did, that was a poor way of stating it. What I'm trying to say is I think the well-established rule of law that it's not so important what you call something, it's what it is.
But, I mean, I understand you're saying these words we have held to mean certain things, but at least the cases that I have written down that we have addressed it have very different language. I mean, they use the word must, but it's no action shall lie against the company unless, as a condition precedent, the insured shall have fully complied. And so it's accompanied by other language that's much more definite than the language is here. You have a duty to see to it, as opposed to unless you do. The import just seems to be much different to me.
And I would respectfully suggest that it's a distinction without a difference, that these are conditions preceding, that under the language, that's the way they should be construed. I don't think they're a covenant. I think they're a condition preceding because they fit the definition of condition preceding. And if I spoke poorly, I apologize. I'm not meaning to say that headings don't matter. But for instance, in motions, we all know that if someone calls something a certain type of motion, you don't look at what they called it, you look at what it really is. And that's what I'm trying to say here.
Would the same apply to condition preceding to Section 2B? If a claim is made or suit is brought, you must immediately record the specifics of the claim or suit and the date received. And if you don't do that, then liability doesn't attach.
That would appear to be a condition precedent to liability. I've never seen anyone deny liability on that ground.
Well, but it certainly could.
Could be. And I will now make an argument that I expect that the petitioner might make, because there is a line of cases that is cited in the briefs that says to the effect that we're not going to have conditions result in an absolute forfeiture when it's not reasonable to do so. And it occurs to me that arguably that might be the case under that particular
or case. Under C, you and any other insured must immediately send us copies of any demands, notices, summons, or legal papers.
Now, I think that would definitely be a condition preceding.
What if you just don't send? I mean, there's a letter from the lawyer, which is a legal paper that has nothing to do with the merits of the suit or the conduct of the case. It's a change of address.
I would expect that what that means, if I were trying to interpret it legally, is it would be a demand letter or a suit.
Or any demands, notices, summons, or legal papers received in connection. It's not just demands or a settlement. Any legal paper received in connection with the claim.
I think legal papers would logically be construed by this or any other court to mean a suit or a demand letter, and not a change of address.
Well,
deposition
notice.
Well, that would invoke the cooperation clause of the insurance.
I'm just saying that, but under your, we can read through this paper and through the policy, and we see you must. You're done if you don't do it. It's condition preceding.
So, the court is asking if someone doesn't send a legal paper.
If the court doesn't, if the insurer doesn't in B. Record the specifics of the claim. That's condition preceding. If it doesn't, in C, send a deposition notice. That's a condition preceding, and there's no liability under the policy. And then we can read. I mean, there are other places in here that we can find.
Well, I think we would probably fall back on the rule that the petitioner has cited to the court, where we're not going to have a forfeiture over something that's de minimis. And I frankly think not sending somebody a change of address or something might well be de minimis, but I don't think not telling them you've been sued would be de minimis. I think that would be pretty important.
So if you told them you'd been sued but you didn't send them the suit papers?
I don't think any insurance company would do very well in front of a court arguing that would defeat coverage.
But under your argument it would.
No, under my argument I don't think it would, because I think that would be a total de minimis kind of a failure to comply with the condition preceding. Which, as the petitioner has cited in his brief and cited several cases, the courts don't allow that. And that's something that the courts don't look upon kindly. And I think a couple of the cases cited, for instance, is somebody made a tender into the court, and the condition preceding, and it was held to be a condition preceding, required that the tender be made to the party. Well, the court said, yeah, it's a condition preceding, but we're not going to enforce that condition preceding to allow an extreme forfeiture or a penalty under those kinds of circumstances. But not telling an insurance company about a suit, and not telling an insurance company that a claim's been made is not de minimis. That they need to get in there and be able to investigate and defend the matter. That's not de minimis at all.
But if there's no prejudice, how can it be more than de minimis? I mean, if nothing prevented you from coming in and defending it or hurt the insurer's position, then why wasn't the failure to forward it de minimis?
Well, is it fair to afford it de minimis? Because for all we know, the insurance company could have done something. And we just stipulated there was no prejudice for the purpose of this case, for the purpose of this summary judgment. There may well have been prejudice ultimately when this moves forward.
Do you agree that the modern trend among, at least in the common law across the country, is to require prejudice?
I would say that the modern trend isn't, by virtue of the fact that the Illinois Supreme Court just 5 months ago went to the contrary. Well, now, I will say that the majority.
That's one decision. I'm asking about the trend.
I can say that the majority does not require prejudice. I can say that. And I don't know what I would call a trend. like I said, the most recent highest appellate authority I read would favor our position. The majority rule appears to be to the contrary, so I don't know if I call it.
Any further questions?
Mr. Banowski, you know, I'm not interested in being outside of the mainstream or turning 100 years of precedence on its head. So how do you prevail here when it was argued just now that language has changed but the result hasn't in these type of policies?
Well, I haven't seen the Nevada case, as you know, wasn't cited in the briefing, and I haven't had a chance to review the case and what the specific language was in that policy. But if this court meant what it said in Hernandez, and that is that an insurance policy is a contract, and that it gets treated like any other contract, then what that means is if we're going to determine what the effect of the language is or what the effect of the terms are, we have to actually read the contract. And the difference between insurance policies and just business contracts, I guess, to the extent that it deals with the evolution of the law, is that insurance policies tend to have a lot of the same language. And so if this were just a commercial contract case, we would be pouring all over the language of this contract, and we would, if we rely on any other cases, we'd be pouring over the language of those contracts to make sure that the holding in some other case applied to this contract because the languages are the same. I'm sorry.
What about the response that it's not what you call something, it's what it is, and response to this catch-all?
I think that's exactly the point here. Exactly the point. One of the points that counsel made is these parties were free to negotiate whatever type of amendments or riders to this policy they wanted to. Now, in order for an insured under a general liability policy to negotiate for a prejudice requirement with respect to notice, it's first got to appreciate that the policy is going to involve a forfeiture if there is a lack of timely notice and no prejudice.
But don't you sort of guess that when the policy says you must give notice, but if you don't and it's a bodily injury claim, there must still be a showing of prejudice. But if it's an advertising claim, it's silent.
Well, I guess the point is that we have to really jockey around a lot in the policy to come to that conclusion. And I think the better question is, if you read the notice provision, does the notice provision put the insured on notice that this provision is a condition precedent, the failure of which will result in a forfeiture of the benefit of the policy? And I think that the clear answer is no. In fact, we know that in order to complete the argument that this Section 2 constitutes a condition which leads to a forfeiture, we have to go to some other part of the policy to read language which is materially different than Cut the Hay, which does not include this express condition preceding language, to then infer that because that provision provides that if you don't comply with other provisions, then our lack of compliance here is a condition precedent. The argument that it is what it is under Hohenberg is circular. Hohenberg says generally what a condition precedent is, and we agree what a condition precedent is. It's something that happens after formation, that until it happens, there's no requirement. But that doesn't tell us how to recognize it. The courts are in accord that, and Hohenberg didn't find a condition precedent. The courts are in accord to say how we recognize it is we look and we see if the language includes language which puts us on notice that if you don't do this, there's no benefit.
What about the language under the subsection entitled Legal Actions Against Us? No person has a right under this coverage to sue unless, quote, unless all of its terms have been fully complied with.
Well, I guess that's really what what I said earlier. Well, what that means is that the only covenant that a policyholder makes is the covenant to pay the premium, and everything else that's a burden on the policyholder must be a condition, because that then applies to everything, not just this notice section. Some of the prior cases that find...
So your answer is that language doesn't mean what it says?
No, my answer is that language includes the basic premise that if you've got an obligation and you don't do it, then I have a defense, and it's called material breach. The same language in Cudahy said, if you don't do this, then as a condition precedent. Now, that language, that term, which I would submit is a pretty important two words in the policy, they don't exist anywhere in this policy. And so in order to rely on Hohenberg to say this is a condition precedent, we have to first just assume that it's a condition precedent. The argument is circular because there's nothing in Section 2 here, the notice provision, that tells us that failure to do any one of these things, whether it's record the specifics of a claim, give notice of the suit, send the deposition notice, whatever it is, there's nothing in here that tells us that unless you do these things, there's not going to be coverage. And so in order to say, well, it is a condition because it has that effect, we have to just assume that it's a condition.
And what about the language, unless all of its terms have been fully complied with?
Well, and I guess my point is...
That's not in Section 2. Is that the answer?
Excuse me?
That language is not in Section 2. Is that the answer?
No. The answer is that recognizes the general proposition that if you've got an obligation under this contract and you don't perform, then that constitutes a breach of the contract and it relieves me of performance. But I think that comes under the general notion that it's got to be a material breach. Counsel conceded that if I don't record the specifics of the claim or suit, well, that wouldn't be a material breach. I mean, where do we draw the line? Counsel conceded that even if it's a condition precedent, that a line has to be drawn. There's something that is too de minimis. And so if we go to Section 2B1, well, that's too de minimis. And counsel for the insurance company acknowledged that that's not a condition precedent, or even if it is, we're going to excuse that. And so the question is, what's the difference between that and notice of the suit in a situation where the notice caused no prejudice? And this is a case that came, the stipulation is on cross motions for summary judgment. And so it's dispositive of the issue of coverage, at least with respect to the notice issue. So it's not like we're going to go relitigate the notice issue, because if their motion shouldn't be granted, then the petitioner's motion should be. And I see that I'm out of time.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes argument for this morning. And the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right.